Okay, we are here with Missouri Representative Judy Morgan, an old friend of KKFI.
Yes.
And she is the representative from District 24. And tell us, how long have you been in the House of Representatives?
Sure. It's great to be here. I won a special election in 2011, so I actually started serving in 2012. So this is my seventh year, which is kind of unbelievable. It's gone by pretty fast.
Now, I should know this, but when does term limits kick in then?
And for me, it'll be 2020, so I can run one more time.
Okay.
Basically, that 1 year when I won that special election, that's not used against me because it's normally four 2 year terms, but I get an extra year thrown in so I can do 9 years.
What's it like to have an election every other year? That seems like it's such a busy schedule to me.
What it is, but you know, Bill, when I was president of the teachers union,
right,
you know, we had elections every 2 years, so it was just something I was pretty used to. So that really is no different than what I've been used to. So it's not bad for me at all. And I think there's good parts to it because I think it pretty much makes you more accountable to your constituents.
Right.
You really have to work hard at staying in touch with them when you're up for election every 2 years. So I think that has some good aspects to it.
Now, District 24, help us a little bit. What's that encompass?
Oh, sure. It starts at the river on the north. It goes to 47th Street, basically right there at the north end of the plaza. Along the west, it's all state line. And then along the east, it's basically Troost up to about 15th Street, then it kind of starts veering in a little bit west. So by the time you get down into the River Market, I'm cut off at about Oak. It's really a wonderful district to represent.
Yeah.
My husband and I have lived here all our adult lives, raised our daughter here. So and the people here are great. The neighborhoods are wonderful. So I love representing this district.
Oh, great. And just former on the board of directors here at KKFI.
Yes.
And longtime supporter.
And
so.
My husband and I were in the play that you wrote.
Absolutely.
And it was one of the funnest experiences of our lives.
Yeah.
And your wife directed it.
And you did a wonderful job, too. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about what's going on in Jefferson City then. Let's start with last year. You know, it was the Kansas City Star talked about the gridlock that went on last year. Tell us a little bit about what that was, what was going on last year, and then we can just, you know, move on to this year.
And there was gridlock in certain areas, but of course in some things passed that I was not happy about, like right to work.
Yeah, we had an interview just before the session started,
right,
and I said, how long will it be before right to work passed? She said, about 15 minutes.
Yeah,
it
passed within the first few weeks in the House, and then not too much long after that in the Senate. But the issues that there was gridlock over, basically, I think, was because of personality conflicts between the governor and the certain Missouri senators in the state Senate. The House seemed to be, the House Republican leadership seemed to be more amenable to the governor Greitens, but some of the senators were not happy with some of the things he did. And so I think that created some gridlock, sometimes not to a disadvantage of somebody like me and some of the things I believe in, because some of the things they want to pass, I would prefer they not pass. So and sometimes that actually works to our advantage, too.
I was going to say that, you know, on the federal level, I mean, I've been a fan of some of the dysfunction that's gone
mm-hmm.
on there. I mean, didn't like the right to work. They did enough damage despite the
yes.
dysfunction, but it could have been a lot worse, I guess.
Then, of course, one
I'm
of
saying.
The really bad things we passed last year was that bad discrimination bill that actually makes it harder for people to prove discrimination in the workplace. That was something that passed that you know, I was very sad about that got through. So there were a couple of things that passed that I was not happy about. A couple of things were good. We got Real ID passed. You know, it was going to be that people were not going to be able to get on airplanes with their driver's licenses in Missouri because we did not comply with the Real ID laws that came into existence actually under George Bush, a Republican president. But we finally got our law passed that we will be in compliance. The federal government has given us an extension because January 2018 was the drop-dead date. But they gave us an extension, so Missourians will still be able to use their driver's licenses, and probably in about 18 months we will then go under the Real ID, and people will have to get new licenses to comply with that. But they'll be able to use those to get on airplanes.
So at least one example then where there was bipartisan support,
yes.
right? And
yes.
do you see some things coming up where I know there's some bleak things coming up, and we'll talk about
right.
those. But is there some good silver lining bipartisan things, I guess?
Well, one that I would really hope we can deal with are the lobbyist gifts. This is, you know, right now legislators in Missouri can take unlimited lobbyist gifts. I'm talking about you know, movie tickets, golf outings, fancy dinners, trips, you know, going to the World Series, you know, going to Chiefs games. All of those things are things that lobbyists dole out in gifts to legislators. And we have in the House, we have actually passed a limit or ban on them for the last couple of years. The Senate has not been willing to go along with it. But I'm hoping this year that'll be something that can pass. And I think that's good. I don't support lobbyist gifts. I think it's best if legislators don't take them. And I think it'll be great if we have a ban on them so that it'll no longer be an issue.
I can't imagine an elected official that would be against that reform. So what do the Republican senators say as to, I mean, do they blame it on procedure? I mean,
no,
is it a principle thing or what?
Well, they basically just say, you know, it's not a problem because it has to be reported, which is true. You know, but it's not necessarily real easy for the average citizen to find those reports. They're on the Missouri Ethics Commission website, but you kind of have to know how to maneuver yourself to get to them. And they say, well, as long as it's reported, it doesn't matter if we're taking this money or these gifts. But I think still there's just the perception there that if I'm taking a gift from a lobbyist, then somebody thinks, well, you're probably going to vote the way that lobbyist wants you to vote. And we should be voting the way our constituents believe and the way we believe, and not necessarily because of pressure or a gift from some lobbyist. So I think if you have a ban, then it takes, you know, it takes the real and the perceived problems away. And I think it'll just be better for the functioning of government.
Of course, and well, another along the lines of ethics too, there's the whole dark money thing that went
yes.
on with Greitens. And I don't know if is that maybe creating some allies that you wouldn't normally have just because it's so blatant to what's going on with the governor.
And that's very interesting because, yes, it has created some very unusual allies. The dark money is a big problem. You're exactly right. And this is where contributions can be made from these different nonprofits, and you don't even have to disclose them. And that's what's happened is Greitens has got a bunch of money. Like, for instance, for his inaugural, most governors have already told who paid for it, you know, how much each contributor paid. He won't give out the list. So you don't know who paid for his inauguration.
Right.
And he's got all kinds of other dark money. There's a senator by the name of Rob Schaff, who's a Republican and actually a pretty conservative Republican. But on this issue, he is totally in alignment with those of us who would like some kind of regulation of this dark money. So that has created kind of some unlikely allies.
Well, it strikes me that Missouri, in some ways, seems to be a microcosm of what's going on the federal level.
Sure.
As far as, I mean, some of Greitens and some of Trump's biggest critics on both sides are people from their
right.
own party.
No,
and,
no, that's exactly right.
And that gives you some, even though you may not agree with their stance on issues, at least it gives you some, I would think, some comfort that there's principled people on both sides,
right.
of course.
Well, I think you and I talked about the Missouri State Board of Education right before we came in to do this interview, and that's a perfect example, I think, of where Republicans and Democrats are in alliance on this issue. You know, the governor decided he didn't like the commissioner of education, a woman who was very much supported by the education groups.
And what's her name again?
Margie Van Deven, I
right.
believe was her name.
Yes.
And she had been in, she actually been a long-term employee of DESE, and then she rose to commissioner, and she was hardworking, and she was transparent, and she met with people, and she seemed to be very well liked by all constituent groups. But we suspect that the governor really wants someone who's going to push charter schools and vouchers, and she was not necessarily that person, and so he wanted to get rid of her. So he basically stacked the State Board of Education with the people he wanted, eventually got nominated five out of the eight. They got rid of the commissioner, fired her. And that's very unprecedented. The governor does not get involved in the hiring, firing, disciplining of the commissioner. He appoints the state board. The state board makes those decisions. You know, they're the professionals that know how to do that stuff. But Governor Greitens got himself right in the middle of it, and it created a lot of controversy. And in fact, the chair of the elementary and secondary education, which I serve on, who is a Republican, the chair of the Education Committee in the Senate, both wrote a letter, along with the House Appropriations chair, all three Republicans, wrote a letter to the governor asking him, please don't do this. You know, allow the state board to make these decisions. These were Republicans writing to the governor saying, do not stack the board. You know, let the state board actually make the decision. Of course, the governor didn't do that. So that's turned into really a big problem.
Well, let me ask you about that, too, because I'm curious about that in this, whether the pushback, again, that Greitens is getting from his own party, is it a procedural thing, or is it mm-hmm. I mean, I guess it's pretty standard Republican platform stuff to talk about charter schools and vouchers. Mm-hmm. And I know as a former president of a teachers union, mm-hmm. I know where you stand mm-hmm. on where I stand as well. Mm-hmm. But so it's interesting that he's getting pushback, but is it because of the way he's handled it?
No, there's actually this is kind of interesting. In a couple of areas in the legislature, there is work between Democrats and Republicans where they agree, and charter schools and vouchers are one of the areas. A number of the rural Republicans are not necessarily in favor of charter schools or vouchers, and so I think that some of those Republicans who support education, and some of them do, they are public education supporters, they really truly believe that the state board is the one who should make these decisions, not the governor. So on this issue, I actually think it was based on their policies and what they think are good policy, not necessarily procedure. It was just the policy. This is how good government is run, is you let the professionals make these decisions and the governor doesn't get himself or herself in the midst of all of it. So
the governor, or notwithstanding, maybe a good chance for some bipartisan approach to that.
Right. So, but anyway, now the whole education thing, that the chair of the Senate Education Committee said he will not approve of any of these appointments. This is a little bit confusing, but they were actually appointed in the interim, uh-huh. which means they can act until they go through Senate confirmation. They haven't been through Senate confirmation yet because the Senate didn't start meeting until January. So now they have to go through Senate confirmation. Senator Romine, who's the Senate Education Chair, said, "I will not approve of any of them because they acted totally irresponsibly because they did not know this woman yet. You know, they had not been in their jobs long enough to know her. They should not have fired her." And he said, "I will not vote for any of them." So that was a Republican senator telling the governor that. So now what the governor has done is he has withdrawn all five nominees but reappointed them because if they had, under the procedure of the governor nominating them during the interim, the Senate would have had to have decided something on them in 30 days. By withdrawing him and renominating him, they have all session. So I think the governor is trying to buy time to see if maybe he can talk the senators into supporting these folks. I don't know what's going to happen. Yeah. I'm hoping that maybe the governor will get some sense and will realize that he needs to nominate some people that are professionals who care about public education. We'll see what happens.
And you are listening to Radioactive Magazine, and our guest today is Missouri Representative Judy Morgan from District 24. If I understand what the newspaper is saying, that there's now three people that are on, and there's not a quorum. So what is the effect of not having a functioning board, and how long might this go on, I guess?
Right. Well, actually, until, in fact, Charlie Shields, who is the president of the state board, who used to be a state senator, he's one of the three left, not nominated by this governor, nominated by a previous governor, and he said, "We can't do anything. We can meet, but we cannot take any action whatsoever." So they're right now in the midst of approving the new standards for the Missouri's education. They can't do anything on that. They may be able to meet and get reports from people, but they will not be able to take any action whatsoever until at least two more board members are confirmed.
And you have any? I mean, there's no way of knowing, but how long is that likely to take if there's people that are
dead
set against it?
Oh yeah,
I guess, from the Republican side.
In fact, one of the other senators, who's Senator Schaaf, the one that the governor has really gone after big time, said he would filibuster indefinitely, basically. So it could go on a long time. Yeah. But in the meantime, the state board is not going to be able to take any official action until they get at least two more members, so that they have five of the eight there. So it's really crazy. But the governor deserves the credit for this whole debacle.
Yeah. The credit or otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's see. I probably the other major issue, I mean, there's lots of major issues out there, but taxes. Talk a little bit about taxes. What's going on with taxes?
Well, a lot of stuff is going on with taxes because of the federal tax law and the whole change in the exemptions. our Missouri tax law is coupled to that, so we are going to have to change our exemption part of our tax code to what the feds are. And there's estimates all over the place about how much money that's going to cost Missouri's government. The lowest I've seen is $50 million. I've seen up as high as $500 million.
It had not occurred to me that the changing in the federal law was going to impact states and, yes. and reducing their revenues just automatically.
Right, because of the way ours is tied
sure.
to the...
And I'm sure we're not the only state in that situation.
Right, yeah. So we don't really have a handle yet on how much it's going to cost the government. Some of the Republicans have said, well, $50 million we can withstand. I don't feel that way. We couldn't find $35 million last year to just provide those in-home health care services to disabled and elderly people. And if we can't find $35 million for that, I sure don't want to lose $50 million. And that's probably the lowest estimate we will lose. And my guess is it's going to come in more than that.
Now, if I understand, there's at least a bipartisan attempt to replace that money as well, the ones you were just referring to, is that right?
There is a bipartisan effort to replace the $35 million to put those folks back on their in-home health care.
In different ways.
You're exactly right. In different ways, some of which we like and some of which we don't. But the whole tax thing is so we're facing that. We're facing that issue, and we could change it. The state could say, the legislature could say, we are going to keep our exemption law the way it is now and stop it from being in the same as the feds, but we would have to pass a law to change it. I don't know if there's going to be the appetite to do that. We'll lose money that way. But the bigger issue is, basically, there are some legislators who want to take us down the path of Kansas.
Because that worked out so well,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and so it would be lowering the taxes for the LLCs, the limited liability companies, which is what Kansas did, which caused them to be in terrible financial shape and not have money for their schools or roads. And they basically, there's some people in the legislature that then want to make the income tax zero for everybody.
Right.
For the companies and for individuals. And
I don't see how there's any way of replacing that money without decimating the poor.
If you tried to do it through the sales tax, it would be astronomical, how much more you would have to charge people in sales taxes. And, of course, just as you said, that's going to impact poor and middle-class people more than high-income people. So that's a real issue that we are going to have to deal with. Then there's another bill that was passed. I believe it was before I got there, and it's if a business pays their taxes on time, they get a 2% discount. Now, do you get a 2% discount for paying your taxes on time? No.
Not lately.
No, you don't. But only businesses, they get a 2% discount. So one of the Democrats has already filed a bill to eliminate that and say, you shouldn't get a discount just for paying your taxes on time. So that will generate some income if we can do that. Somebody else has, another Democrat has filed a bill to, we don't have any, there's no taxes on your internet purchases. And there's a whole federal government compact that states are going into to go ahead and tax internet purchases just like they would if you bought it at a regular store. So that would generate some more income. So we'll see. Those are some things that we're trying to do to hopefully generate some more income.
Yeah, and again, I'm kind of like Harry Truman. The only thing I know is that I read the newspaper.
But right.
Reading the Star, they were talking about by doing away with tax credits as well. I don't know if there's that's probably all over the place. I mean, there's probably some that's a good idea, some that aren't. I don't know. But can you talk about that a little
sure,
bit?
Sure. One of the tax credits that the governor has really gone after is the low-income housing. There's also the historic tax credits. And, of course, an area like this in my district has really benefited from both of those tax credits,
sure.
both the historic and the low-income, because it helps, it helps preserve old buildings. It helps build low-income housing. So those are tax credits that I think are actually pretty good that we ought to keep.
And I was reading something about, and I'm not trying to do gotcha things here. But there was like $140 million that of matching money that we could have come up with for low-income housing? Not matching it, we're just leaving federal money on the table?
No, you're exactly right. Yeah, there's you know, a lot of those programs have matches, so if the state doesn't do anything with them, if they don't contribute any money, they don't get the federal money. So, yes, we'll be losing out on the federal money, not to mention changing subjects, but, of course, Medicaid expansion that we could have actually bought into and got, you know, had health insurance for a lot of Missourians and not have to pay anything for a long time. And that's a lot of federal money that we're also leaving on the table, which is really just tragic, in my opinion.
You are listening to Radioactive Magazine, and our guest today is Missouri Representative Judy Morgan from District 24. So on the healthcare side of things, just talk a little bit about what's going on, well, with the opioid crisis, for example, and a little bit about Medicaid expansion. That's probably not going to happen, but what are some of the needs we need to have in
healthcare? Yeah, and let me just say about Medicaid expansion, I think that's probably my greatest disappointment in the legislature that we have not passed that. That was something that I think it was my second term. Governor Nixon, you know, came out in favor of it, and I was really hopeful that we would be able to pass that, but it's just hit a brick wall in the legislature. It would benefit so many, maybe up to 300,000 Missourians would get health care that don't have it now. And so I'm really sad that we haven't been able to do something with that. The opioid crisis, like you said, that's another issue we're dealing with.
Do you have a feeling on how bad that is in Missouri? Is it as bad as...
Yes, I think it's very bad, you know, and it doesn't affect just urban areas. You know, sometimes people think of drugs as just urban areas. It very much affects rural areas. It is I think that is more of a bipartisan issue that could possibly be dealt with. One of the ways to counter it is through the development of a prescription drug monitoring program, which every state has it except for Missouri. We are the only state in the nation without a prescription drug monitoring program. And what it does is it's a database where doctors can look and see what prescriptions you have. So if you go to four or five different doctors, then they can look up and see what prescriptions you're taking. And what it does is it does two things, basically. It will keep people from doctor shopping to actually buy drugs to sell on the streets, which happens, and it will keep people from doctor shopping to over-medicate themselves, you know, because then maybe they are really in some real pain, but rather than, you know, go to one doctor and figure out how to deal with this, they'll just go to different doctors and get different painkillers and stay on them. And it's really crippled the lives of some folks by doing this.
Sure.
So if we had a prescription drug monitoring program, then doctors could get a better handle then, because, you know, Dr. A may not know that you've gone to Dr. B, C, D, and E and gotten the same prescription and you're really over-medicating yourself. So
pretty well established that that's where the opioid crisis came from.
And I read an article, I hadn't really thought about this, it talks about a lot of people who work in manual labor, you know, because they have injuries, then they end up having to take painkillers, and then sometimes they get into this vicious cycle. The woman who actually is the sponsor, has been the sponsor of a prescription drug monitoring program law in Missouri for the last 3 or 4 years, and she's from a very small rural town. She's a Republican. She was a single mom, had her kid at age 15. Her daughter actually became addicted to painkillers after, like, slicing her finger open at a restaurant and really being in pain as a result of it, and then finally just, you know, using the painkillers and graduating on to something else. So she's very passionate about the issue. I don't agree with her on a lot of other issues, but I totally agree with her on this issue. And we have been able to get it through the House every year I've been there. And some years before I was there. But we always got stopped in the Senate, interestingly, by that Senator Schaaf, the same one that's on our side on dark money, that did not want the prescription drug monitoring program. So
why?
I believe his concerns were about privacy. He felt that it's an invasion of privacy. That there's a possibility of the internet, you know, the records being hacked. But I mean, let's face it, everything we deal with, we have unfortunately a chance of being hacked. You have to put safeguards in. And so other states have done this, and they've been able to do it without, you know, having a lot of problems. Now, the governor put forth his own prescription drug monitoring program, which is almost useless, because all it does is it does not allow the doctors to access who's getting medication. All it does is try to set up something to look at what he calls the bad actors, the doctors who are overprescribing intentionally. But that's not the big problem. The big problem is people go to a bunch of different doctors and those doctors don't even know.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why you want this database. The governor's proposal won't help with that at all. We need a real prescription drug monitoring program. So I'm hopeful. It almost made it through last year. It actually was the last day, as I recall. And the last step in the process is it goes to what's called the Fiscal Review Committee to look at the fiscal note on it. I'm on that committee. We passed it out of that committee, but it didn't make it back to the floor. So it was very, very close to passing last year. So maybe this year will be the year, I hope.
Okay. And we mentioned before we went on, you know, that typically the notion is that if it's an election year, you don't have much going on legislatively, but it looks like you have no choice this year.
The conventional wisdom has always been, well, if it's an election year, nobody wants to take any hard votes, and so you're not going to get much done. But it's like I've said before, I feel like conventional wisdom's just thrown out the window anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, you really, a lot may happen or nothing may happen.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting. One thing we haven't talked about, I don't think, is infrastructure, though.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No,
and that's a very, very big one. Missouri has a huge highway system. You know, we're like the seventh biggest in the country or something like that. And yet we're probably 4 or 5 from the bottom in terms of spending on highways. And, you know, if anybody's driven I-70, they know what I'm talking about. If you look at the Broadway Bridge, you know, the different, our bridges, our roads are really in bad shape.
A lot of bridges in this state.
Right, really in bad shape. You know, several years ago, a sales tax was put forth to the people. They voted it down. It was pretty resounding, as I recall. I think it was 60% to 40%. I think that a lot of people didn't want it for a good reason, that the sales taxes do hurt poor people again more than they do people with more income. So there was a transportation task force that met all last summer, went around the state, and I think their recommendation is to put a vote to the people to raise the gas tax and the diesel tax. So the legislature would simply put it to the people, which actually we have to because of the Hancock Amendment, because
right,
we can't spend it without the people approving it. But hopefully, I'm hoping that'll pass, and I'm hoping people will be willing to vote for it, because there's just not enough money in the budget without getting some other funds in. As cars have gotten more efficient, people are not spending as much on gas, which means therefore not as much as coming in taxes to the state coffers, and that's where they get a lot of their money for the for transportation purposes, is through the gasoline tax. Ours is, I think, it's very near the bottom. You know, one of the maybe 6th or 7th from the bottom. We pay like very little in gasoline tax compared to
like
other
our
states.
Cigarette tax.
Yes. Well, and that's kind of interesting, because the Star did a really good editorial on what they thought the legislature
uh-huh.
should be doing. And they talked about the infrastructure, but they also said, and by the way, we only have the lowest cigarette tax in the nation. And so we really need to think about raising that. But again, that would have to go to a vote of the people. Although we can actually raise, staying within the Hancock Amendment, we can raise taxes around $100 million a year. So we could actually be doing things to help out our state budget, but the legislature has just been unwilling to even talk about raising taxes. Even that $100 million a year that we could legitimately raise and not, you know, violate the Hancock Amendment.
Okay. Well, we're up against a hard clock right here. We're completely out of time.
Oh, okay, okay.
That's great. A lot of information in the short 30 minutes that we have here.
Okay, okay.
But thank you so much for
representing
the district and being a good advocate for the folks you represent.
Thank
you. Thanks for coming into KKFI.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad to be here.